So good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for coming. We will have a come and go right now because some people told me they would come after finishing some very important negotiations everywhere. For the first point concerning the intergroups, I hope that we can get another slot than only the Thursday's morning because this is one of the difficulties to organize things, and this would enlarge our possibilities to really have a good sequence of different presentations. So this intergroup, especially the part that we wanted to have as Greens, was dealing with free software. We called it very generally free software, and what we want to do right now is to have a first look at the issues like why does freedom matter? Why free software and public administrations go very well together, and there are some success stories already well known, even if one of the most important success stories are finished out of monopolist reasons, let's say. Let's put it that way. And that, of course, in public procurement, provisions have to be set so that free software really gets a chance. That's one of the big things. And, of course, something about what can the European institutions do to really foster free software. We have two very distinguished guests today. This is Mr. Carsten Gerloff from the Free Software Foundation Europe. He's coming from Germany, from Berlin. No,
from Aachen.
Aachen, yes. Well, and Ms. Jeanne Tadeusz from April, coming from France. Is exactly from where?
Paris.
Well, whatsoever. Why do I ask? So I think I first will give the word to Carsten, and then to Jeanne. And we will have some first presentations and then the possibility to ask questions and to intervene. Please.
Thank you, Eva. Let me just see. I had instructions to play with this. Yes, very good. All right. Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Eva, for having us here today. It's a really great opportunity. And thank you all for coming on this sunny Thursday morning. We're very glad. I believe this is the first meeting of the intergroup.
Yes.
So
this was out of this Thursday morning slot that we didn't really go
for. Right. I see. So what we want to do today is just start with a basic introduction on why software matters and why we believe that free software is so crucial to the information society we're building today. And then we get into, as Eva said, to two of the key problem areas and opportunities, the free software in the public sector and the public procurement of software. And at the end, we have some next actions to discuss. But let's just dive right in. Why does software matter? Because software is what controls computers. And computers are everywhere in our daily lives. Just before this meeting, I thought for a quick moment about when have I used a computer today? And I believe it started around 7 a.m. when my mobile phone woke me up. That's a computer. And then I went to take a shower, thankfully with hot water. That water was heated by an electronic heating, which contains a computer. And then I used the hotel lift, again controlled by a computer, walked out the automatic doors, used the tram that has computers in it, and so forth. What I mean to say by this is computers are everywhere in our lives today. And the question of who controls those computers does matter quite a lot. Because computers are the tools for our work and for our self-expression. So whoever has control of those tools controls our work and our self-expression. And that is why I put the image of a printing press on this slide. When the printing press was invented a little more than 500 years ago, people very quickly realized that it's an instrument of power. And that is why you had to have a license in order to use a printing press. You needed to get permission very quickly. It was regulated. With computers today, we're in a more fortunate position. Everybody can own them, and when you're connected to the internet, you can talk to whomever you like. But still, how you talk to these people, and actually sometimes what you can say, is regulated by the software that runs on those computers. So free software is not a technological issue at all. It's an issue of power. It's an issue of control. And that makes it an issue of freedom. That is why free software matters for the information society. What is free software, actually? When do we say that a program is free software? It's when it gives its user four freedoms. The freedom to use the software for any purpose, as you wish. The freedom to study the program and understand how it works. That involves looking at something called source code, the human readable form of the program, the form that it's written in. The freedom to share the program, to give it to others, just like you would share a tool with other people. For example, when your neighbor comes and says, hey, can I borrow your hammer? You say, of course. When your neighbor comes and says, hey, can I borrow your tax program? You say, I signed a license that told me I couldn't give it to you, and I'm sorry, can't help you there. So both the hammer and this tax software are tools. Why can I give one to my neighbor and not the other? So with free software, you can do that. You can just say, oh, sure, here's a copy. Here's another one for your friends. And the fourth freedom, finally, is the freedom to improve the software, to make changes, and pass on those changes so others can profit from them. Any program that gives you these four freedoms is free software. Any program that doesn't is not. It's simple as that. It's not a matter of programming language, technology used, age, copyright holder, whatever. Doesn't matter. The way this is implemented, these four freedoms are implemented, is by something called licensing. When a developer writes a software program, she automatically holds copyright in that program. It's just like when you write a book or make a movie. And that gives her the right to decide how this program will be used and distributed, under which conditions. And with free software, she says, well, yes, I'm the copyright holder. I am all-powerful as far as this program is concerned. So I decide that you get to do with it whatever you like. And here are the precise conditions for that. And these precise conditions then are called a license. So it's just a little legalese stuck on the program. Some well-known free software products are, for example, on the, what is that, left, the GNU operating system, and in the middle, the Paunchy Penguins, the Linux kernel. Together they make up the GNU Linux operating system that runs on so many computers, whether it's servers, desktops, laptops like this one, a very large share of web servers on the internet that run free software, or many embedded devices, again, those trams and heaters and so forth that make our daily lives more comfortable. They tend to run the Linux kernel, the router in your offices. And then, of course, the Firefox web browser, which is perhaps the most widely spread desktop piece of free software. And, that should suffice as an introduction. And I'm handing over to Jeanne for free software in the public administration.
Okay, so thanks, Kirsten. The point is, we've seen what free software is, what the words actually mean. The question now is, why is it important for you, for everyone, and especially for public bodies? First of all, what are the assets of free software for public administration, for governments, for local authorities, and so on? And also, we're going to see quickly some examples of free software usage by different public bodies and public administration, and successful stories about how and why it works. So the importance of software freedoms. So Carson told you that there are four freedoms for free software. Those freedoms, they actually allow for some very important characteristics for the software. First characteristic is durability and sustainability, meaning that once you have the software, you have the opportunity to reuse it the way you want, which means you can use it as long as you want without having to worry about licensing issues, about the fact that the company that sold it to you it might not be working anymore or might not be interested in that product anymore. You just know that the product is going to stay there, that the software is going to stay there, and you can keep using it. And if it doesn't work so well with your new applications, for instance, you can modify it, since you have the freedom to modify it as much as you want. So you have the certainty that this choice you're doing is going to be durable and sustainable. The same way, the freedom to modify means that you're able to tailor the software to your own needs, meaning that if you need some extra application, extra macros, for instance, you can just add them to software, like do it internally within your public administration or ask someone to do it for you. But in any case, there's no issue of whether or not a software company might or might not agree to it, might not answer either, for instance, to your questions about it and to your demands to actually modify it. You just know that you can do it. It's safe. It's allowed. It's also about reusability, meaning that if you, for instance, you're a public body and the software is working well and you want to give it to other administration, for instance, you use it for your municipality and your neighbor wants to use it as well, you know you can share it with them. They can use it the same way you do. There's no issue about it. And finally, there's no licenses cost and or licensing issues, which means simply enough that you're not going to be worried about the cost increasing or going to have any uncertainty about these kind of issues. Yeah. Also, there are consequences coming not directly from the freedoms, but they are enforced by the way free software works. It's interoperability, which is a more and more stringent issue lately, especially in Europe. Meaning that interoperability is the knowledge that systems can talk to each other without any kind of issues. By using this, free software, usually they use interoperable formats, which means that you're sure that whatever you're doing as a public administration can be reused and shared with your users and citizens. Without any worries it might or might not work, or for instance that your citizens might have to buy some software at some point just because you've chosen to use that one. Which happens?
In the European Parliament.
Okay.
Oh, didn't know that. Say.
It's also about open standards. Open standards mean that the document, for instance, format you're using can be used by all kind of software, which come back to the same kind of issues, but
still.
It's about everyone being able to communicate with everyone, which is more and more crucial right now.
There has been a petition on that in the European Parliament in the last period, which had a lot of support.
Yeah, but it's still not
absolutely fulfilled, but I must say, in the most sectors, they are working on that, and we get more and more possibilities.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
But that's at least a small step.
Yeah, small steps. It's important. Yeah, and just in general, all those positive opportunity given by free software grants some new certainty for public bodies, so the possibility for all citizens to communicate with public bodies, also the avoidance of vendor lock-in, which means that you're not stuck into one only subcontractor. You can just choose to go to someone else afterwards, and so there's no worries about cost, about the vendor going out of business, and all those kind of issues. Just imagine when you're using proprietary software from one given company, I don't know, for your operating system, for instance, what happens if it goes out of business? What's going to happen to your system, all your data and everything? Free software just gives you the certainty that you can always find a way to reuse it and it's going to work out. And finally, it's about generally a better use of public resources because of also sustainability and interoperability and so on. Yeah, so a few examples, because we've been talking about theory, but the practice has been put into place. I'm going to start first with my home country, because that's what I know best. It's about the Gendarmerie Nationale, so the police in France. They've been moving towards free software for the last 4 years now, And they're hoping that in 4 years, over 85,000 desktop computers will be using free software only, meaning the operating system, the web browsers, the Office suite, and so on. Everything's going to be free software. And what's amazing is that it works. And people, the users, they're very happy about it. The plan has been going as good as it could have. And it's continuing. And they are actually planning to develop it and put it forward as a good example, because it's just being implemented well, very well, and it's feeling great. Same goes for Andalusia and Extremadura in Spain, where they've been moving the schools and public administration desktops to free software. And also in Sweden, there's been framework contracts favoring free software and open standards. That's all nice and good, but that can also prompt the question, why aren't more public bodies and public administration using free software if it's so good? Well, we've identified a few issues, something we've been working on, but still give some problems. There's a vendor lock-in and format issue, meaning that it's a real cost, and it's often complicated, or at least felt as complicated, to change. Meaning to change the type of software which is being used. Just changing the name of the software sometimes is hard with users, because you have to do a migration, you have to explain why we're changing. It has a cost in terms of human terms, also in terms of teaching the users how to use a new software, and there is a cost in terms of migrating all the previous data into the new formats, for instance, sometimes. So, but that's being slowly changed thanks to a new realization about the need for interoperability and avoiding vendor lock-in. So the example of the European Parliament is pretty telling, because most of the time the choice in terms of which kind of software we're going to use are not made by doing a deep analysis. It's just because of history, just because it's always been done that way. But now that they're getting stuck, they're starting to wonder about it.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. If I may come in for a moment on that, we have this problem in the European Parliament that historically the decisions have been done in favor of one of the leading companies, and now they even prolonged the contract. In addition, they are trying to open up, because the protests are getting more and more, of MEPs, for example, to use their own non-proprietary software in this house. So it's a double strategy which doesn't really make a big sense, but anyway, it might be kind of these transition periods.
Yeah. Hopefully, yeah. And in general, so that's what you've been talking about. It's also about back procurement practices and the way it's done. And yeah, Carsten's good. Tell you all about it.
Thank you. I will speak a bit about procurement. Now, why did we actually pick this very exciting-sounding area of public procurement that really makes European citizens jump out of bed in the morning and take to the streets and shout, "Improve procurement!" Why did we pick it for this meeting? Well, as will soon become apparent, just as Eva and John mentioned, just last month, to put it in plain language, we believe the European Commission screwed up big time. I'm allowed to say that, I believe. So, excuse me? Thank you. So that topic has some currency, and we believe it's very, even so, though public procurement tends to be a bit of a backwater, or to be perceived that way, we believe it has, the way it's done, and the way procurement is being handled in Europe's public sector really determines to a large extent how well Europe's digital economy will work and how well Europe's software economy works. So that determines how much innovation we will have, whether European software companies will be able to compete with ones from with companies from other places in the world. And So just let me run through the basic rules on public procurement. There's a directive, 2004/18/EC, that talks about public procurement, that talks about guaranteeing the opening up of public procurement to competition. So competition is a key goal for public procurement processes. That, for example, means mention brand names in calls for tender only when it's absolutely necessary, when there is no other way to describe what sort of software you're looking for. There usually is such a way. You don't have to ask for a specific vendor when you just want an office suite. You don't have to ask for a specific program when you just want something that does email. There are so many of these things out there, and the functions are usually very well described. There may be difficulties in other areas. I'm not sure about construction or bathroom fittings or anything of the sort. But
tell you it's the same, huh?
but I'm sure it at least can be done better in software. And the other point that I like to highlight is public bodies should use negotiated procedures only in certain circumstances. Negotiated procedure means you don't do a public call for tender and say, hey, anyone who thinks they can sell us this, write us an offer. You say, well, there's this one vendor, and I think these guys do it best, so I'll just go talk to them. You can probably imagine that that has a really negative effect on competition if it becomes a widespread practice. So, is it? Public procurement accounts for about 20% of the EU's GDP. That's 2.2 trillion euros, that's 20%. And I believe it's fair to assume that public procurement accounts for a similar share, if not a larger one, of the software market. In software, the practices are really quite bad, as we've seen. A recent report by a group called Open Forum Europe has, I think, 13% of calls for tender from the last 3 or 4 months of 2010 mentioning brand names in software. That is something that should be, again, used for only in exceptional cases when there is no other means to describe what you're looking for. And, well, I believe there usually is. And there's a growing, that actually is down from something like 20-25% in earlier years. But instead, there's a growing use of negotiated procedures. So public bodies will just go to the vendor they know and ask them, well, can you sell me this software? And the vendors will say, oh, sure, be glad to. Here's my invoice. And that's pretty much how the European Commission did it over the last, well, I don't know, 7-8 months. At least, and many, for many years before that. In 2 months ago, in May 2011, the Commission signed a contract for 55 European institutions, including the Parliament, to move to Windows 7, so the next level of the second next level of the version of the operating system, the Windows operating system. Now, the great thing, if you ask the Commission, the great thing about this contract is it didn't cost anything. Isn't that great? 55 European institutions, I don't know how many dozens of thousands of computers, and it doesn't cost a penny. Well, that's because they already had a framework contract with a Microsoft reseller from 2007 that said they could always get the newest version. We'll get to that in a second. Now, it's probably just a coincidence, I believe, but at the same time, the Commission felt the urgent need to conclude a service contract with Microsoft for 44.7 million euros because, as it happens, Microsoft is the only company, the only vendor capable of providing service for all those Windows operating systems because they're the only ones who really understand the system, who know how it works, and who can make changes to it. So that justified the use of a negotiated procedure in this case. And the European Commission says, well, we asked them. They said, well, no, we're not doing this because we're locked into this particular vendor. It would just have been too complicated to migrate all the data out of it and to rethink our structures. And also, to be frank, I guess they were a bit late. That's because they waited until the very last minute before the old contract expired to conclude a new one. Otherwise, the people who wanted this in the Commission, they argued that, well, if we don't do this now, we'll be left without our IT systems. To which the reply can only be, well, you knew 4 years ago that this contract was going to run out now. Why didn't you get going earlier? So as a result, money has been wasted. and the Commission and those other 55 European institutions, including this noble house, will keep storing huge amounts of data in proprietary formats where it will be hugely expensive to get out of once someone in the Commission sees some sense and gets a different software solution. But fortunately, it's not all just sadness and tears. In some places, some countries are doing better. For example, in the Netherlands, in Belgium, in several Spanish regions, in Malta, some Italian regions, and also in the UK, there are rules that public bodies must consider free software in public procurement, that public sector software solutions must respect open standards. Those are standards that can be implemented by anyone without asking permission or paying a fee. And increasingly, in many European member states, public bodies are also obliged to at least read the open document format, the key competitor to Microsoft's proprietary DOC or XML formats. And there are some examples of countries actually getting it right. Here, this one is from Sweden. Sweden has a centralized procurement system, meaning whoever wants to buy software in the public sector usually goes through one of two organizations. And one of these organizations, responsible for national government plus, I think, hospitals plus municipalities, had a good idea. They said, we do framework contracts all the time with vendors. So basically, it works like national procurement authority goes to vendors, says, let's agree on terms and conditions. They do that, but no money flows. And then the public, for example, a municipality of, let's say, Gothenburg, can go and say, oh, we need software. And they go through that framework contract to the vendor. They don't negotiate. They just get a price list and a product. Very easy. Municipalities love that because procurement is a hassle. So this organization signed framework contracts with 5 Swedish SMEs to provide free software solutions to the Swedish public sector. They selected these companies for their competence in free software, demonstrated experience in that area. It's very easy to access because many things in free software projects are public, for example, mailing lists, so you can see who's been active, who has contributed code. If that company has contributed a lot of code, they're probably competent in this particular area. And they took a number of steps to minimize risks for the customers, such as copyright lawsuits, patent lawsuits. All these programs will have to be made available to the public because they're paid by public funds. So why not give them to the people who paid for them? And I'm really happy to see this emerge, and I hope that more public institutions will follow the Swedish example. Now, that was a quick run through the current state of procurement. I'd like to hand back to Jean for next actions. What is it that we'd like you to do now to make sure that Europe's software economy, not just free software, Europe's software economy stays competitive? Because many companies are making a lot of money with free software. Don't be confused. It's free as in freedom. It's not free as in beer. There is a lot of money to be made there. Jean?
Yeah, thanks. It's really important to just remember that it's not about free products that you don't pay for it. It's all about non-profits and so on. Actually, I don't know for the rest of Europe, but in France there's been studies showing that free software companies actually being much more innovative and hiring much more, even though it's a recession, than the rest of proprietary software companies. So there's been some success on that, and especially economic success on those kind of models. So what's the current next actions? What's the current issues going on right now with free software in terms of policies, politics, and what can and should be done? So first of all,
I'm just going to jump in here because I added this at the last minute. The European Commission has just released the rough numbers for the next research framework program. So I haven't seen the numbers, but it's probably somewhere in the 3-figure million euros range just for ICT research. We really want to make sure that a large chunk of this goes into research for software that will be available to all Europeans. to those people who pay for it. And that the easiest way to achieve that is to make it free software. Simply put a license on it, put it on a server somewhere, the rest people will take care of if it's interesting. This sort of research provides the foundation for companies to set up businesses, to employ people, to pay taxes, and so forth. So creating a strong focus on free software research in the upcoming research program is very important, and right now is the time to do it.
Thanks. So the second important issue is public procurement. So as Kirsten has talked to you about, already, but really the issue is about opening up the processes, making sure that everyone can compete on procurement and procurement practices, especially for public tenders. We're not even saying that you should always favor free software, but at least the rules should be clear that everyone is allowed to try to get to get public contracts with the government. And especially since the public tenders are here to actually, for public bodies and public administrations to see who's there, who's on the market, what can they offer, for which price. Then there's selection procedures which might select the best software. So maybe it's going to be free software, maybe it's going to be proprietary software, who knows. But at least the fact that free software could be allowed to compete on equal footing is really important, just to make sure that all the entrepreneurs on the field and all the innovation actually there and offered to public bodies and public administration. Then the two next issues I'm going to talk a bit about are the unitary patent and standardization procedures. They're a bit different issues, but still they relate very strongly to free software and to the general framework they're working in and thriving on. So, okay, so the unitary patent. You've probably heard about it. It's this new big European title for patenting, which would be applicable to 25 countries in Europe, thanks to a Hans cooperation that's being discussed in front of the Parliament right now. So, yeah.
You said only mildly exasperated.
Yeah. So why is it so complicated, and more importantly, why is it an issue for us as well? It's not that we disagree on the idea of a unitary patent. It could be good for patenting, maybe make it quicker, maybe make it easier. I don't know. It's not our problem with it. Our main issue is that the current proposal is focusing on giving pretty much all the power to the European Patent Office, which has been known for its let's say, very legal practices of legalizing and granting software patents.
It's actually, sorry if I may come in here, but it's interesting that we discussed this on the day following on the fifth anniversary of the rejection of the Software Patent Directive.
Sixth anniversary.
More coffee, please.
Six years ago, the European Parliament rejected the idea that software patents. It comes down to the fact that patenting is about patenting processes, industrial processes, not about ideas or concepts. The threat of software patents is very, very clear because it's easy to see it in the US, especially when software patents exist to some extent, and where functionalities can be patented, meaning that you have seen patents on things like one-click buy. One-click buy is a patent, so you cannot do it anymore. Only the companies that patented it, in this case was Amazon, could do it. Or, for instance, Microsoft had patented the progress bar, meaning the bar that goes from 0% to 100%, goes slowly up and up, well, sometimes down, but most of the time up, supposedly. It was patented, so no one could do it anymore. So it's a huge threat to innovation in general, in all fields of software, proprietary software, free software, everyone actually. I think like something maybe like 99% probably of companies working on software are against software patents. Even there's been new studies in the US, recent studies, I think a few weeks ago, showing that software patents have actually cost much more money to all companies and actually made some kind of new value. It's just something that creates extra hurdles. It doesn't mean that software is not protected. Software is already protected. It's copyright. It works very well. There's been implementation in front of courts. There's been no issue with that. No, the idea that patent, there have been some issues, but nothing worse than, I mean, it's working. It's really working. And so software patents, on the other hand, have been known for creating a lot of problems and deterring innovation. So the EPO has been for a long time in favor of the software patents for various reasons, because
heavily.
Of who's inside?
Heavily.
Heavily, yeah. Mostly because of the people who are inside, who are often judges and patent lawyers, who would love to get some new patent litigation on software. It has already put forward a proposal in 2005 to legalize software patents, which the Parliament had rejected. It had been trying to do it regularly ever since. It has gone to the point that the civil servants inside the EPO has actually made a strike, against the practices made by some people granting the patents. It has gone so far that the higher court, Board of Appeal has actually made a statement saying that the EPO was going too far and that legislative powers should come back and check and legislate on it. And so far, this proposal about the unitary patent is just giving a go-forward to the EPO, just granting, making them keep on going that way instead of making more check and balances. We're not even talking about prohibiting it or anything like that. It's just that it's crucial that legislative power and the European Parliament keep really their, keep their ability to legislate on patent issues and to check on everything that's happening. And also the second issue, quickly, just the second issue is that for this unitary patent to function, there has to be a court, because nothing can be unitary if there's not one court for everyone. That seems pretty rational and logical. And so far, the proposal from the Commission has been to make a court, a specialist court, which doesn't answer very much to anyone, which is a big issue. I mean, how can you make a court that is not being answerable, at least to the European Court of Justice, for instance, at least for appeals? It's a very new and unique kind of process, and it's been they've been trying to push it forward, so it's really crucial that there is some kind of overview about all these topics. So the standardization issue is about, it's been going on, it's more and more important right now, seeing there's been a directive on standardization reform that's just been starting to be discussed right now in front of European institutions. It comes down to what the definition of a standard is, meaning, so what we've told you before is like a standard is a format that should be usable by everyone without having to ask permission. This definition is actually coming under threat by various sources, including, sadly enough, recommendations from the Commission. And it mostly comes down to what they call a fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory licensing condition, knowing that there's no definition for fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory, meaning it can be whatever you want. Pretty much, it means that if you want to use the standards, so the standards is what everyone should use because it's a basic format for everyone, you have to pay some money to the guy who invented it. That might not seem too shocking at first, but imagine that you have to pay them, and the product that comes from your product, I have to pay them, and the product that comes down from that product, that comes down from that product, I have to pay them. And we keep on going, and just imagine that if every single software which uses which kind of which specific format, for instance, I don't know, .html, if every time .html was used, there has to be some kind of fee paid back to the guy who invented it. Just imagine the enormous cost and how it's like stopping and putting a huge issue on innovation.
Can I come in?
Yeah, sure.
I think that's a very important example to raise, because the Internet and the World Wide Web, as we know it, have grown based on standards that are available royalty-free, or where the patents that are included in those standards are available royalty-free, which means if you want to build a program that writes or interprets HTML, for example, a browser, you don't have to ask permission. You don't have to pay anybody anything. You just go and do it. If you want to set up a website, you just go and do it. Just imagine if you had a sort of licensing agency that you need to go to and get permission from in order to set up a website. I don't think the Internet would look very much like what it does today. And the key problem for free software with these so-called fair, reasonable, non-discriminatory standards is that they're unfair, unreasonable, and totally discriminatory against free software. Because the patents, when patents, sometimes hundreds of patents, are included in the standard, and you go and write a program to implement that standard, then you have to pay licensing fees to all those patent holders under a fair, reasonable, non-discriminatory regime. With free software, with many free software licenses, that means you can still release your program under a free software license, but anybody you give it to and who wants to redistribute it, because, as they are permitted to do by your license, again, has to go and pay those fees. And that, there are some very important licenses like the GNU GPL, the General Public License, the most widely used free software license, that prohibit exactly that, that prohibit attaching additional conditions to software that you pass on. So this is why FRAND is really a very dangerous issue for free software. Standards for software must be royalty-free.
Yeah. And just imagine if, like, licensing, like, FRAND issues, you just have a split between those people who are able to use it and those people who aren't. And you're just cutting effectively yourself and public administrations, like, cutting themselves from the citizens, for those who might not have the means or the wants or the overall ability to pay for this kind of software, which needs to be paid now. So there's a huge communication issue and just a gap between citizens and administration, and the communication between those two is just lessened and worsened.
Next.
Yeah. Just as a conclusion and on more just to see like general issues, there's been some initiatives going on internally which we felt should be also mentioned because they're very important and they've been doing a lot of great work inside the European Parliament Commission. There's OSOR first, the Open Source Observatory and Repository, who's been working on open source, so free software and also open source software very widely.
That's a commission project, by the
commission,
way.
Yeah, commission project. And there's also the European Parliament Free Software User Group, which was created a few months ago, and which actually organizes meetings regularly to just promote the use of free software within the Parliament and to see how it can be done and improved and enhanced.
Yeah. And I believe to help people who want to work in the Parliament and to want to use free software.
Yeah.
So that's a... from my experience, that's a very good point to go to and get advice if you just want, I don't know, Mozilla Thunderbird to work with your email.
Okay, I think that's it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
This is where you can find us.
So thank you very much. This was
very interesting, I think, and I just some comments about the current state of play which we are facing, especially the two of us in the legal committee dealing with the patent issues. But there's you touched upon one very important point, which of course is very crucial and is also under discussion right now in the European Parliament, and this is public procurement rules. We have one big problem there, and this is that these procurement rules got so difficult in the meantime that nobody who's not an expert, a legal expert on procurement, is no longer able really to do it. So I think one of the first things will be to simplify those rules so that they can be much easier applied, because if you make it complicated, there's only one choice, and this is, for example, like in Sweden, where you have one institution more or less doing all the procurement issues also for smaller entities, which also brings about a little bit the danger. If this then is biased, you get a major problem for all of them. Whereas if it's done on a lower level, you might not have those problems. But anyway, I think... if we come to a point where we can say simplify it, then we, of course, have better effects. We see the same, and I had it on the table in the last period, in the car manufacturing issue. Because also there, it's like with the, all those service contracts, we had these spare part issues on the table, where the big automotive conglomerates tried to monopolize the spare parts too. And the spare parts, as all the drivers might know, are extremely costly. Mm? So they don't earn any more on the car, but on the spare parts. This might be an situation if you have service contracts.
Actually, can I come in here for a second?
Yeah.
That was another point that we found very concerning about this decision by the European Commission to just extend the contract with Microsoft, because they argued, this is just an upgrade. We bought from them before, and now we have all this stuff, and now we so now these are the only people we can go and buy from, really, without making an extra effort. Our point is, if that argument is valid, which public body will ever have to do competitive procurement again? You bought chairs that interlocked from this one vendor, so you'll be buying from that for the rest of your existence. Great. Competition, wonderful.
No, that's in clear contradiction to all the anti-monopolist rules that we have in the European Union, which are also very useful and which I defend. So this is one other battlefield where we really should have a look on, because this is creating monopolies, and monopolies never do well for an economy. We had experiences on that all over in Europe. A second point is the whole issue on copyright reform. So in this whole area, we have to take care of not only if artists and so on and so on and the users are balanced, but also how do the new regulations touch upon software? That's very important, and this has not come up yet because it's all focused on this whole artists question and creators question, but it is not yet focused really on this part of copyright regulation. You touched upon the whole issue of patents and the different proposals here. I will have in the legal committee another issue next week, and this is about trying to involve the European Parliament in going against the two member states that were not agreeing on this enhanced cooperation for creating a unitary patent. I do not like that, but the majority in the jury committee will agree on that. Enhanced cooperation, in my point of view, is not the best way to go, because we will have to MEPs have to organize to get something done which is their right. Yeah. I mean, we had this petition in the last period which said very clearly the European Parliament is an institution where every MEP and every citizen must be able to address the institutions of the European Union, not only in his or her language, but also with his or her means. And this concerns, of course, the choice of systems that you have. And I think this accessibility is a very important point. The problem is that the Commission is running a double strategy here. On the one hand, they are enhancing monopolies, and on the other hand, they are trying to create kind of a secret garden for all those who are not content with the dominant system. And I do not think that this is the right way to go. You have, from the beginning, to choose for an open way. We are paying billions in the European Union for interoperability on railways, which touches upon a lot of regulation. This costs billions because all the member states have to adapt. But if it comes to something that would not cost but would benefit, it's getting much more difficult. This is what makes me sometimes a little bit sad. But anyway, I'm waiting for your contributions and questions and so on. Please. I think maybe you might add something on the whole patent and so on question, because we are working on that together.
Yeah, okay. Christian Engstrom, Green member for the Pirate Party. First, I'll comment on what you said on procurement. I think all the arguments for free and open software are perfectly valid. But there are two arguments that are extra valid for public procurement. The first one, when you talked about open standards, archive persistence. I mean, many of the documents that are produced in the public sector need to be retained for 10 or 20 years, and many of them need to be retained forever. Literally forever. Knowing who owns a particular house, etc. You really can't accept to have the contract when the house was bought or sold in a format that nobody can read. I mean, that's completely unacceptable. So that's extra important for many public sector things. The other one that I think is extra important for procurement purposes is national security. Many systems, not all systems, of course, but many systems are very, very critical. For instance, if you've got a big system for having everybody's medical journals in it, you really want to be absolutely sure there is no backdoor. And, of course, with closed-source software, you can never know that. I mean, perhaps there isn't one, but maybe there is, and there is no way of knowing. And that's not acceptable from a national security point of view, because if there is a backdoor, either it could be, a foreign power, if relations may be totally friendly now, but they could deteriorate. I mean, that's one risk. The other risk is, of course, that if there is a backdoor, some clever hackers might find it. So I would stress those two arguments extra in the context of procurement. But then, on patents. Lovely subject. I'm in the Legal Affairs Committee together with EFA. Our sort of the green working position currently, first of all, as EFA said, we're opposed to enhanced cooperation. Enhanced cooperation means that not all the member states are members of it, but only a few, 25 in this case. That's one thing. But then, going beyond that, we're not opposed to the unitary patent as such, to use an emotionally loaded term. For us, I mean, the core thing for us is to have whatever new patent system we have. I mean, first of all, it does make sense to have a patent system that covers all the countries together. I mean, if you want to have a patent system, I mean, it's ridiculous to have it divided into 27 pieces that adds lots of costs and lots of legal uncertainty for all companies and everybody involved in the field. But for us in the green, as I said, working position, the core thing is that whatever new system we have must be 100% properly integrated into the European framework of institutions. As it is now, I mean, the EPO is sort of, we've got the European Union here, and then we've got the EPO somewhere outside. Neither the Council of Ministers, nor the Commission, nor the Parliament have the political control over the EPO in the way that they have over, I mean, all other institutions, like the OHIM, for instance, Office for Harmonization of the Internal Market, which is the funnily named trademark office in Alicante. That's properly integrated. It is an EU institution and just like any other institution, whereas the patent system is not. And that is really the core of the green position. Then, of course, I mean, once we... I think the unitary patent could be a great improvement over the current system with lots of national patents and the EPO and just regular case. But then it needs to be done in the proper way. Good things that we have going for us in this debate. First of all, The idea that things should be properly integrated into the framework to be proper European institutions, I mean, that's not just something that the Green Hippies think. It's something that the major groups agree with generally. So that's a good thing. Including the Liberals, yes, and the EPP and the SND. So that's good. And the other thing we have going for us is that the ECJ, the European Court of Justice, came down with a verdict a month or two ago, was it, something like that, saying more or less this, that the proposal from the Commission is completely unacceptable, exactly because it places the power outside the European framework, and that's not how we do things under the blue and yellow flag. But that's sort of the state of play. I get the impression that nobody really knows what to do with the unitary patent thing after this ECJ verdict. But that could be a good thing as well, because I mean it means that all party groups would agree or should realize that there is a need for reflection on these issues. So, yeah, that's my comment.
Well, just to come on that, the opposition of two member states was because of language questions. It was not a fundamental thing. They said that also Italian should be translated and Spanish. Spanish and Italian should also be under the languages in which a patent has to be translated, which is, of course, means more cost for patentees, just for information. So, please.
Yeah. Getting back to your point on, first, thank you very much for the detailed update on the patents and procurement issues. One detail on the procurement thing, you're probably, being from Sweden, you're probably familiar with the study done by one researcher, Björn Lundell. Then you must hear about it. So a Swedish researcher, I'm not sure which university right now, he did a little study last year. What he basically did was write to all Swedish municipalities, Sweden not being such a large country, you can do that, and said, your meeting minutes, your council meeting minutes are public, so will you please send me your meeting minutes from 10 years ago, from the first meeting of, I believe it was 1999. And since Sweden has a national rule that documents must, that public institutions must be able to read and write, the open document format, he first sent that request in a letter in the open document format and asked for the minutes to be provided in ODF. Now, an amazing percentage of institutions needed several reminders, then turned out they had trouble opening the original ODF, the letter. A lot of them came back saying, oh, gee, you know, we archived those minutes in a doc format, and now we can't open it anymore. Some went back and installed old versions of Windows and Microsoft Word just in order to open those minutes. That was 10 years ago. This is council minutes. It's not the contract for the House. But still, these are public documents that must be available by law. And there are obviously very serious and widespread flaws in the system, in the way these documents are archived and made available to the public.
May I come in on that? Because I had a long discussion with libraries. How can we really secure that also in a historic perspective, not only 10-year-old documents as you were talking about, but even more, that digitized documents, for example, can be readable for the rest of the time? So I think, what do you think are the major requirements for having a regulation that really would solve that problem, that we have changes in formats and then documents you can't read anymore? This can be very relevant if it's, for example, a last will. Right. Nobody can read it anymore.
So
it might be a problem.
I guess one key requirement from the software side, there are several aspects to the problem, software, hardware, system. You can have wonderful hardware, but if the house that it's stored in burns down, you still have an issue. So from the software side, what you you want to store these documents in formats that are fully and publicly documented in tons of places. So whenever one implementer or whenever even when the last company, let's say, to implement this particular format in their software has died out, you can probably still find the documentation. And you can even, of course, if you have a working system for archiving things, make that documentation part of the archive. Yeah. And then anybody can go and write a new interpreter for the format. Just like with the HTML standard, even if there were no browsers available today, you could still take the standard and write a browser that would just work. There's another group that has an interest in these issues, and that's social security institutions. Because they need to keep records on people from the day either they're born or they turn 18 until they die, and then for 30, 50, 70 more years. That can easily run into 100 plus years. There's one IT company that has been around for 100 years. It's called IBM. There is no other one. I'm not betting on IBM being around for a second century, and even I'm not sure if they can open their old formats. So, yeah, that's what we can say from the software side, from the hardware side, I'm not sure. In general, librarians are excellent people to talk to on open standards, on copyright. They have very good ideas, and they're extremely tough, I've learned.
This is also a future challenge, because if we now start to digitize old documentations to really have a secure storage for them, we also have to choose the format for the future. So this is always a little bit difficult, but what will be a format that really could stand there for another, let's say, 50 years. I don't want to go wherever. If we can't really get into a development that makes some structures about that, we have to print out and keep print copies of everything on the very, very weak paper we have right now. I mean, the Gutenberg stuff, not the minister, the former minister of Germany, but Gutenberg with one T. This was a good quality paper, but what we have, for example, documents from the end of the World War, they are in a very poor paper and they are falling apart. So we really have realistic problems also concerning juridical questions. And I think this has to play a major role for the future, I think. I would be very happy if there could be kind of joint proposal of the whole free and open software sector and the format interested people and working together with libraries and so on to create kind of way forward for this legally very interesting and important point. Because this is what I really see as a future. We will have lots of cases where documents, where last wills or documents for working contracts and so on can't be opened anymore.
Right. I think that's one very good point for the research program that we talked about earlier. That is probably something that should be in there. Something else that should also be in there is distributed systems. The earlier this year, we saw many uprisings in North Africa and the Arab region, and there was a lot of writing talking about how about the role of technology in these uprisings, because they were organized through short messages on mobile phones, through Facebook, through Twitter. Now, I personally believe that the role of technology might have been overemphasized, but in general, what became apparent are two things. One is the power of technology to help people organize for freedom. The second is how easy it is for the government to just shut down those systems when they become annoying. You can simply turn off Facebook in your country. You can, if you're a government, you can simply turn off Twitter in your country, and you can make people's mobile phones receive messages that say, go home, everything's okay, we'll give you a bribe if you stay home and do not revolt. It's all been done. Vodafone, I think, took a bit of heat for their cooperation with the Egypt government in that day. So my question is, can we come up with systems that have this power of mobilization, that let people talk to each other, that let them relay messages between them, and let them organize with such great effectiveness, but that cannot be shut down by a central government, that cannot be controlled by a single agency, that have no single point of failure? Those are distributed systems, and those are being developed. Some of the most important researchers on these issues are based in Europe, and but it's still, the area doesn't have the prominence it should have. That is something else that I personally really want to see in the research program. Europe should help us create systems that guarantee freedom.
Are there any more positions or questions on that? Because I think this is a very critical thing. I mean, I was always very interested in history. As you mentioned, these uprisings in Northern Africa. If I go back to, let's say, the Bavarian-Prussian War, you have documents. You don't have documents on that. So if one might be interested in things like reconstructing what has been the first steps and in a certain development, it will be really difficult to reconstruct how things have happened, because storage is an unsolved question.
Well, I'm actually not sure. I'm not sure I agree.
Yeah.
There is, on things that happen right now, there's so much data being produced. All those tweets, for example, the person who tweeted the raid on the Bin Laden headquarters or hideout or what you want to call it, all this is this sort of data was previously unavailable. It would never have made it into a historical document. Yeah. On the other hand, it's all in the hands of Twitter. And if Twitter falls over, as it does about three times a day, those documents are gone. Yeah. So we need to find another way of archiving those in the public sphere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why just open formats, open standards are becoming more and more important. Yeah. Because if you cannot save and store the data somewhere else, and what if Twitter shuts down, everything disappears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
that's
interoperability, open standards, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
it's not only inside your computer, it can be also on the internet, and in all online services as well. And it's coming more and more, it's being more and more important, and taken, I think, more, starting to get taken into account.
Are there relevant standards developed for digitalization of books, of artworks, and so on and so on? Is this already done in the, let's say, scene?
I would have to look it up. I'm sorry, I don't know that.
Uh-huh. Because this is, of course, one of the things that we will touch upon when it comes to regulations for libraries and so on.
I would say that, I mean, generally speaking, when you talk about persistent formats, et cetera, I mean, more or less everything has moved into SGML, which is just ordinary letters that you can read by hand. And the syntax is very, very, very easy to parse. So I think that provides the persistence for eternity. But then, of course, you need the exact specification of what the different tags and the structure are. But anyway, it's possible to read and to reconstruct. So I would say that it's probably. I would consider it okay to put in legislation or in demands in procurement or whatever that it has to be persistent, and I think that an SGML format would fulfill that. I think.
Cédric Ivry from the EPP Group. I have to add that normally in library they use also the PDF format as an archiving because it's also an open format, even if it's you cannot modify it unless you pay some fees. But I have also a question about some major issue about our critics about open source software. It's often said that there is a lack of support and that it is difficult to implement and maintain. So did you have some recommendation for a unit or IT unit who want to implement open source software?
In fact, yes, thanks for the question. So as with any other software, you really want to look at the vendor that, or the service organization that you're getting it from. And you want to make sure that that organization is capable of delivering whatever they deliver. So if you're a really large institution, it's probably worthwhile talking to a large vendor like Red Hat or IBM. It might also be that for a specific thing, you can be happier with a smaller company. The nice thing about free software is, and that is something that proprietary, non-free software does not let you do, if you're not happy with that particular vendor, you simply go find another one. It's very much the service model like we all use, for example, our cars. When I'm not happy with my car mechanic, I find another one. So free software lets me do just that with my IT solution. And depending on the area you're working in, you will find more or fewer companies that can provide support for a specific solution. Usually it's more about building a solution out of pre-existing components, because a large part of free software is about not reinventing the wheel all the time, but rather just take the 90% of your solution that are known to work and add the other 10% plus a bit of glue between the components, and then you have a solution ready to go. So that's one side from the demand side, that's one thing you need for if you're the public institution, you want to properly look at the vendor. And with free software, you will, in most areas, usually find someone who's capable of delivering what you're looking for, and ideally more than one company. Now, in the mid and long term, the reason why Jean and I keep harping on about procurement is precisely that where there's demand, there will be supply. That's what the market says. And if there's more demand from public bodies for free software services, many, many IT service companies, whether they exist today and do something else, or whether they don't yet exist, will start working in this area simply because there's money to be made. So with the institutions, the public bodies that I'm familiar with that use free software, I'm not aware that they have trouble finding support, at least not more so than the other institutions have with their proprietary partners.
I would add one thing. If you can choose your service institution, it gives you the choice. If you are dependent on one of the big vendors, you are dependent on those regional representatives that they have chosen. If they have chosen a bad guy, you have to live with it. This is a little bit, I bring again in this example we had on the spare parts for cars, huh? Because in the initial debate, they were convinced that only Mercedes could make good spare part for Mercedes. And they wanted to prove it by a study that spare parts not produced by the big companies would be worse than the others. But it resulted in a very difficult situation because statistically non-significantly, but visibly, the other spare parts were better. So this was, of course, a big battle because I'm certain that still people will choose to stay when they have a Mercedes with the Mercedes spare parts. But you have problems, for example, in the regions. Out in the region, you don't find in a village or in a small city with 10,000 inhabitants, there is not necessarily for every provider a service point. So there you get the problems. This is why I'm really in favor of opening the market, because this is also a regional question. If a big vendor is not interested in a certain region, you won't find a good service person there. And that's the problem that I see. But about the institutions, it's another issue. I think really that it's nicer to choose yourself than to be dependent on choices of others.
Maybe just to add to that, you basically raised, the point you're raising is that of lock-in, basically.
Yeah.
Once, with a proprietary solution, once you've made the contract with the original vendor, it's not impossible to get out, but it'll be very difficult, as the Commission has just demonstrated. And because they did not break out this time, they will be paying much more dearly when they eventually do decide to break out, as I believe they will eventually.
Yeah.
So,
if they face competition, they get better even
better. Yeah, and that's another point. When you use free software, your suppliers know that they have competition. They know you can leave, and that tends to keep them on their toes. They don't get lazy. With proprietary vendors, once they have you locked in, they can basically dictate the terms, and all you can do is do the calculation. Will it be more expensive for me to get out today or in the next couple of years, or accept those conditions, even though they're really a lot worse than what I got when I signed the contract originally, and then you make that decision. With free software, you don't have to do that. With free software, you can just say, oh, you raise your prices, interesting, but I just talked to this colleague of yours at the other company, and goodbye.
And just quickly to finish on that, there's also often the issue that since it's easier to get out, there's no lock-in in free software. It also means that the demands of the people who are getting some support and maintenance on free software actually higher than on proprietary software, because they know they can get out. So it's like, if it doesn't work, it's bad. We're going to get out. So make it work. When it's proprietary software, it's like, okay, it doesn't work, it's too bad, but, you know, we don't have a choice.
Throw away the computer.
Yeah, throw away the computer. But there's also always, I don't know, I don't have any studies on that or anything, but there's often, somewhere, at least sometimes, the case that they demand a higher level of support or maintenance because they can't get out, so they can get something else. If for maybe 6 months the functionality is not as good as in another software, they can decide, okay, do it now, or otherwise we're going to get out. When the question doesn't often enter the minds of the people who incorporate software, because they cannot get out in any case.
I believe that also relates to people finding out that they have a choice. Most of us grew up and started our computing lives basically in a proprietary environment where we learned that we do not have a choice. Mm. It's just what you get. Mm. And if you're lucky, you get to choose between Windows and Mac. Now you have the choice. You can simply install any of, I don't know, hundreds of GNU Linux distributions or other free operating systems. And they all look differently and work, well, they work similarly, but slightly, it's all in the details. So go find the solution that suits you best. And this experience of choice sometimes just blows people's minds.
I think, yes, we should try to promote the open source software, but I believe now it would be difficult to implement it on the desktop, especially, because you have lots of limitation due to all the history of the software which were installed in the house. So, but you can maybe make a transition to go and at least to leave the choice to the members here to try the open source software, like for just example the use of Firefox. We just have one browser here, but it's because there is lots of application that doesn't work on Firefox, especially the application which allow you to follow the plenary session. So, yes, I think we have to foster this.
But
this open source
software. It's a long-term process in any case.
Migration transition
is always a long-term. I'm seeing, for instance, it works in the Gendarmerie Nationale in France. But why does it work? Because it was a 10-year plan?
Yeah, it's what to say.
It's been going slowly, step by step.
It has a big cost.
Explaining to the users and getting support and...
And the issue also is normally the user doesn't want to know. They just have something, tools to work properly. They don't want to be bothered with...
But when the change needs to be done at some point, I'm seeing, for instance, typically in the gendarmerie, they were using very old software, so they're actually very happy to get the new free software because it's new, it works faster, it's easier to use, it's more user-friendly. It's a small step, long step process, but actually, the user, user feedbacks. Migration is always a challenge. And there's always a transition period, and I don't think we can imagine that, we can have a big political decision, let's just change the free software, that's it. It's always going to be a long term process.
Yeah, though I've learned that the political will is actually the key component in any migration. It's usually not the technology. The technology generally works or can be made to work. Yeah. I've also learned regarding migrations, and you mentioned the aspect of users having to get used to different software. Now, one of my first internships while I was studying was with a newspaper. And they had, a proprietary layout system. And there was a minor upgrade from version, 2.4 to 2.5 that added a couple of buttons somewhere. The newspaper took in all the staff, all the writers, for half a day of training to show them these two new buttons. It was not only excruciatingly boring, it must also have been very expensive to the newspaper. That was a minor migration, but I've seen many public sector migrations from proprietary to free software managed with just the same level of effort. And I know that also managing a migration and retraining users when you migrate from, let's say, Windows XP to Windows 7 involves the same process. It's also costly. All these changes cost money. So while you're paying for that migration anyway, why not migrate to something that will be cheaper in the future and that gives you more choice in the future? In free software, we're not... At FSFE, we're not looking for charity from public bodies. We're not saying, please buy free software because we're really nice. We're saying buy free software because it's better for you. And just open up the competition and you'll see. That is all we're asking.
One point in that, I think... it's not only, if it comes to the European Parliament, it's not only political will, but it's also political duty. If we want citizens to follow in all possible formats, we cannot oblige them to have a Microsoft player installed if they want to follow the parliamentarian sessions. So this is, here it is also a political request that we have to follow, but nevertheless, if it comes to the free sector, of course, it's as you said. I think we have to close the sessions because the votes, we will have to go to the votes right then, and I think we really should continue this debate and maybe next time face a little bit or focus a little bit on security questions, because this is something that I learned in the example of the Foreign Affairs Ministry in Germany, that they in the end have chosen the free software solution because of security reasons. And I think this might be an interesting point to touch upon, since the big issue of cybercrime, stolen data, and so on, is getting more and more prominent on the agenda also of the European institutions, because there's a big pressure to go for that. So I think if there's no more extra question, I would... please.
Just on migration, so it's often described and as a very difficult and costly and heavy process, and that's maybe normally the case. But just to, on the other end, some migrations on very simple things just happens automatically without anybody actually thinking that it is a migration. And in our group, there has been no decision, no coordination. It just happened that we quite often use Doodle to arrange a meeting. So an application that is a bit faster, a bit more easy to understand, click here, and suddenly you're organizing a meeting with something that it's not integrated in the desktop in the parliament. And some parts of the migration can be seen as it just happens because it's a bit easier and it's not a very heavy process. So there's the full range of different processes from that it just happens, migration, and that it's a really heavy, everybody come and learn these two buttons for a half a day arrangements that you described. So just wanted to add that perspective.
Okay, so thank you very much. Thank you very much for coming. And I think hopefully we can get a time slot which is not the Thursday morning in the future, but this decision is to be awaited. But I think we will continue on these issues, maybe next time focusing especially on issues like security questions and so on and so on. Thank you for coming, and have a nice vote. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you.